If I may, I would like just to touch briefly on a few things that came up in the argument just before me. I believe there was an important question asked whether, if you reverse here and adopt our interpretation of CAFA, would the state ever be able to bring a restitution claim in state court? And the answer is yes.
Well, the answer I got was no.
And that's why I want to clarify it. Because this was something that was on the minds of Congress when CAFA was enacted. And I have to keep going back to the language of the statute. And if you, it's reprinted in our main brief. There are several ways that that can happen. On page 54 of our brief, 53 and 54, there are exceptions. See, Congress, there was an amendment offered in Congress to exempt parens patria actions from mass action jurisdiction altogether. That amendment was defeated. So people were thinking about this. And there are exceptions in CAFA, which say on page 53 of our brief, this is 1332D3, which says when a district court may, in the interest of justice, decline to exercise jurisdiction, if those specific exceptions are met, it can decline to exercise jurisdiction, and there could be a restitution claim that would stay in state court. And then in item 4, it shall decline to exercise jurisdiction. And one of the things, it shall, if there's a defendant who is a citizen of the state involved, it shall decline. And then when you go over to the mass action section of 1332D11, there are further exceptions. And that's on page 56 of our reply brief. If all the claims arise from an event or occurrence in the state where the action is filed, there would not be mass action jurisdiction. Congress was thinking about this very carefully because it was dealing with the competing interests that we've been discussing here today. And here's a very important point. If the district court is affirmed here, this is what Senator Hatch talked about on the floor of Congress. And I'm not saying that you should go by what he said, but it illustrates this point. If the district court is not reversed here, CAFA mass action jurisdiction can be totally gutted by any state who wants to do it. Because all they have to do is pass a statute allowing an attorney general to bring a subset of claims as parens patria, and CAFA mass action jurisdiction is over. And private plaintiffs can do just what has happened here. They can decide to withdraw their claims from the federal court, team up with the state attorney general, and we'll be back with the same problems Congress was trying to address.
Well, Congress could go back and straighten that out too, couldn't they?
They could. But we have to be mindful of what the Supreme Court said in Exxon versus Alapata. It's very important not to give a statute an artificial construction that restricts jurisdiction more narrowly than Congress intended. Very important. And also in Exxon versus Alapata, the Supreme Court said, Congress is not required to speak with any special clarity when it modifies the jurisdiction of the federal court within constitutional bounds. And it further said, normal principles of statutory construction apply. That's from the Supreme Court in Exxon versus Alapata, a case that this court has acknowledged in its Palisades opinion. So I think if we look at the language of CAFA, in my time, I would like just to look at it with you. And I have to keep going back to the language.
Are you going to do so in the context? Are you going to be talking about mass actions?
Yes. I'm going right there now. And forgive me if I read, but I find this statute has so many words and clauses that I have to keep looking at it. And if you want to look along with me, we've reprinted this on page 55 of our main brief. The main mass action part was added to the diversity section, 1332D, and it's 11. And 11B has the definition of mass action. And this is Congress's language which supports the real party and interest principle. Mass action means any civil action, and I'm paraphrasing here, except a class action in which monetary relief claims of 100 or more persons are proposed to be tried jointly on the ground that the plaintiff's claims involve common questions of law or fact. That's what Congress said is a mass action. It didn't say You look to see if the state has an interest in some claims or not claims. It just says, if this case includes claims of monetary relief of 100 or more persons, and the word persons is very important there because...
But not plaintiffs?
It uses persons first.
Then it uses plaintiffs.
Then it uses plaintiffs. And I think it's very important to understand what Congress meant by plaintiffs. It did not say named plaintiffs, as it did in the Moss-Magnuson Act when it said there would be class action jurisdiction.
Does it define plaintiffs in here anywhere?
You can see the definition of plaintiffs clearly in a number of ways. And the first way you see...
But a plaintiff in a lawsuit is normally one that's above the V on the cover sheet.
That is not the way the Supreme Court used the term in Zahn versus International Paper. If you read that decision, it's talking about class actions. And in that decision, the Supreme Court over and over again refers to the members of the class as plaintiffs in Zahn. And here, in the context of a sentence that uses the word person...
But this is not a class action.
This is a mass action. But it's using the word plaintiffs.
But class action, one becomes a plaintiff in a class action because there are certain procedural formalities that bind the affected individuals. And that's not necessarily true of a class action. And here, the phrasing is one or more persons are proposed, the claims of one or more persons are proposed to be tried jointly.
Yes.
On the grounds that the plaintiff's claims involve common questions of law or fact.
Yes. And I say to you that just looking at that sentence alone, the word persons informs what plaintiffs means there. And it shows that Congress meant people with claims. And if this is reinforced when you turn over to the exemptions. Over and over again, the courts that have interpreted jurisdictional statutes have said you look at the exemptions to see what the terms mean. And if you look at the exemptions in 1332 DB2I, the public interest exemption, which I'll get to later, which is in Roman numeral 3, there's a parenthetical in there which makes clear that Congress believed that mass actions would include claims brought on behalf of individual claimants, on behalf of. Because there's that parenthesis, a public interest exception is accepted when all the claims in the action are asserted on behalf of the general public and not on behalf of individual claimants or members of a proposed class. So that shows by clear implication that the people in a mass action could be, the claims could be claims that are brought on behalf of the claimants. That's more evidence. Also, the mass action provision says that the mass action is a class action removable under paragraphs 2 through 10. So paragraph 2 of subsection D is incorporated. And that is reprinted on page 52 of our brief, and that is the minimal diversity statement. And that section also shows that when Congress is using the term plaintiffs in this statute, it is not limiting it to named plaintiffs. If you look at 1332 D2, it has three subcategories of minimal diversity. Each of them includes the phrase, any member of a class of plaintiffs. Any member of a class of plaintiffs. And we all know that a class of plaintiffs are not the named plaintiffs. They are people whose claims are being represented by other people. And this section is specifically incorporated to apply to mass actions. And as Wright Miller pointed out, in the context of a mass action, it must mean any member of the mass of persons with claims. And if there's any doubt about whether Congress meant to include unnamed persons, you go up to the definitional section in D1D. You see this clear statement. The term class members means the persons, parentheses, named or unnamed. So clearly, for purposes of satisfying minimal diversity and getting into federal court, Congress meant for the courts to take into account unnamed people whose claims were involved. The statutory language is absolutely clear here. And as this court pointed out in its Rosmer opinion and other opinions, once a word like persons is defined in a statute, it seems to mean the same thing in later places in the statute. Once the term plaintiff here is clearly meaning named and unnamed, it means the same thing throughout the statute. So just looking at the language of the mass action provisions here makes it absolutely clear that mass actions are not limited to 100 or more named plaintiffs. Any court that has held that has ignored the clear language of CAFA. And this court has said in its strong opinion that CAFA did not disturb the established ways of establishing and showing diversity jurisdiction. And that has been repeated over and over again, that Congress legislates based on the existing interpretation of the jurisdictional statutes. 1332D has been around a long time, and the federal courts have always said that diversity jurisdiction would be based on real parties and interest. And that means to apply the minimal diversity standard to look at the 100 or more persons, a court must see who the real parties and interest are, all of them. And whether you call it a whole case or a claim-by-claim approach, it's really irrelevant, because what we're talking about is applying the plain language of the mass action provisions of CAFA. And the courts, the Seventh Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, got it wrong because they ignored the language of CAFA. The Seventh Circuit even has, in its opinion, a statement that there's nothing in CAFA that shows that all the claims should be examined. Just flat disregarded the fact that mass action jurisdiction is based on claims of persons. When you look at the public interest exception, it clearly doesn't apply once you realize they were talking about the real parties and interests, because these restitution claims are brought on behalf of the people in South Carolina who purchased products with panels in them between 2000 and 2006. It's a certain group of individuals who serve for an accidental loss. So that parenthesis clearly makes that not apply. And when you look at the amount requirement, it's going to take longer than the time I have to go through that, but the except clause in 1332DB1I means that once you have a mass action, you've got $5 million total amount in controversy aggregated. That jurisdiction will not be extended except to those persons whose claims exceed $75,000. And the other claims have to come within supplemental jurisdiction to be within the jurisdiction of the court. This is a case of international importance, and we disagree strongly with the statement that this case is limited to South Carolina, because what the state is trying to do here is to apply its laws to affect the conduct of people in Asia and people in other states. That's what Congress was concerned about when it decided that cases like this needed to be in the federal courts. That's why it enacted CAFA. And if a state is allowed to team up with private attorneys who are allowed to withdraw their claims for restitution from a multi-district proceeding, as they did here, and then join up with the state attorney general on a contingency basis and bring them again and use that technique to stay out of federal courts, the problem that Congress sought to correct is being allowed to happen.
Could Congress have decided or put in the statute that it wanted the states to be considered at diverse parties?
Yes.
They could change that diversity rule as to states?
They could.
Would have been any constitutional problem with that?
Congress can do that when it does it clearly. And in this case, when a state is the plaintiff, that would not be an 11th Amendment problem.
And that would be, clearly be, it could have done that readily then, or it could still do that.
It could still do that. And it's very important that this case be done based on the language of CAFA itself, because we have a conflict among the circuits. The Seventh Circuit and the Ninth Circuit totally ignored the language of CAFA. The Fifth Circuit got it right, but it didn't go in.
The Supreme Court may have to resolve this anyway, or I guess they will at some point, probably.
One never knows. But
unless Congress decides to fix
it. Unless Congress decides to fix it. But this is exactly the kind of case that Congress was talking about. And this idea that a real party in interest in this case should be determined by balancing which claim is most important is totally inconsistent with the language of the mass action provisions of CAFA. That was a concept that sort of arose from a misunderstanding of district courts who were applying the real party of interest rule in the complete diversity context. In the complete diversity context, it was important to look very carefully to see if the state was a party at all, and if it was, there would be no complete diversity. In this context, when there's minimal diversity, it's important to look at the case to see if it includes claims for monetary relief of 100 or more persons. And if it does, it meets the mass action jurisdiction, and it meets minimal diversity, and it meets numerosity, and the amount requirement is satisfied, and there should be jurisdiction here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parr. You've saved some time, I think. Ms. Campbell?
May it please the court. Senator Mark Pryor did propose an amendment to CAFA. He did it a little bit late in the game, and when you do look at the legislative history, you see that the reason Senator Mark Pryor's amendment was not adopted was because they thought it was unnecessary in parents betray cases. That's one of the reasons why it was not adopted. The second reason it was not adopted is because it had language in there that concerned some members of Congress that plaintiff's attorneys, private counsel, could name the attorney general as a class member. And by naming him as a class member, as opposed to the attorney general bringing the case as the plaintiff for the state, they would be able to find a loophole within CAFA. Certainly that's not the situation here either. And so the reason that the prior amendment was not adopted just doesn't fit into the facts of this case. This is a case that was clearly brought by the state of South Carolina. It is not a straw or a sham party in any means. I was happy to hear my colleague say that you do need to look at the language of CAFA, because when you do, he thought that he told the court, and I may have misunderstood him, when he looked at 1332D1D, I thought he told the court that plaintiffs means persons named or unnamed. What it says is class members means persons named or unnamed. Well, we're not dealing with the class action part of CAFA. We're dealing with the mass action part. So to the extent that Congress put in parenthetical named or unnamed, class members is not a term that's used anywhere in the mass action part of this case. What is used, though, is those two instances where they specifically use the words plaintiffs. Plaintiffs is a term of art. It's been defined by Black's Law Dictionary, 9th edition, as the person that's bringing the claim. It says, a party who brings a civil suit in court. So as Judge King noted, you do look at the first person before the V to determine who the plaintiff is under the mass action provision. Your Honors, this is a case that was brought on behalf of the general public. If you look at the case as a whole or as claim by claim, this case is one brought in the public interest. First one is the forfeitures, the first pot that we talked about earlier this morning. That's clearly in the public interest. The second pot is civil penalties, clearly in the public interest. The third pot is restitution. That restitution is on behalf, under 39-5-50, the Attorney General could not even bring that cause of action unless he thought it would be in the public's interest. If 4.5 million South Carolinians, and many of which by the defendant's own concession are going to be affected by the price fixing, if those amount of people don't represent the general public, I don't really know what would. I don't know where the exception would ever apply. Your Honors, the other point that they make is that on the $75,000 per claim, that is a tough issue. The 11th Circuit's the only one that's come out and discussed that particular part of the mass action provision of CAFA. And candidly, the 11th Circuit came out different, opposite of what the state has argued in this case, and we pointed that out in the brief. What the 11th Circuit did in the Lowry case, though, is it said if you are going to look at the $75,000 amount in controversy, then it's going to be for every plaintiff. You can't, so basically what would happen is any plaintiff who did not meet that requirement would be remanded to state court. So if you, in that situation, if you don't have it to be a $75,000 per claim requirement like we think it is, then you could have a situation that's a mass action in federal court without a mass. Because in this situation, if there were overcharges, it certainly wouldn't be a $75,000 overcharge per TV. And so I think Lowry deserves some attention. However, the court doesn't need to even address the issue of the amount in controversy if you do not think that there's minimal diversity and if you do not think that there's numerosity. What's interesting about my colleague's argument is that in their briefs, they rely on the real party and interest analysis to get to 100. And we've already discussed that this morning, that if even under the real party and interest analysis, they don't get there. The state of South Carolina is the real party and interest for all of the claims.
With respect to your argument about Lowry and that each person has to have $75,000, it's a little hard to see that that makes much sense, though, because there's an aggregate amount of $5 million, isn't there? So if 100 people each had to have $75,000,
it would make the $5 million amount
why
surplus.
Why would you have the $5 million would seem superfluous.
And that's what Lowry held, Your Honor. And
do you have
I think that it would. I think that it would. However, this circuit has never addressed the issue, and so it's certainly one that we wanted to preserve to the extent the circuit, this panel, wanted to deal with it.
Right. And do you have but you don't have a substantive response to that?
I do. My substantive response, Your Honor, would be that we don't have a mass. So first of all, it's not an issue for us.
Your response is we don't get to it.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. You only get to it.
We get to it, we're on our own.
No, Your Honor. If you get to it, you get to it because you've agreed that you look at persons instead of plaintiffs. But if you do get to it, then you would have what the situation. My position would be, and I've put it in the brief, that you would not agree with Lowry.
On what ground?
On the ground that you would have a case in federal court under the mass action provision of CAFA that is not truly a mass. Because in this situation, to the extent that you were looking at persons, very few would have $75,000. And so you would have very few plaintiffs under the $75,000 amount, and the rest, the majority, would be in state court. They cite 1367 as supplemental jurisdiction as a basis that if one claim, to the extent you're looking at persons, and not plaintiffs, that under 1367, you could use that supplemental jurisdiction statute to bring in the whole case, even people who fall below the $75,000 amount. But the case that they rely on, Lowry, rejects that. Lowry says 1367 limits itself to situations that are not covered by other statutes. And this situation, the remand of claims that are less than $75,000, is explicitly called for in CAFA's mass action provision. So even under their own precedent, you would have the potential of a situation where there is a mass action in federal court without a mass. And that's the problem that we raised in our brief that is problematic in Lowry. The mass action provision of CAFA is clear. It's clear that you have to have plaintiffs. Plaintiffs are persons who are named in the complaint that are bringing direct actions. We have to have proposed that they be jointly tried, and, Your Honors, we have not done that. The case is one brought by the state of South Carolina. If you, going back to Navarro and U.S. Fidelity, the Supreme Court cases we talked about earlier, in this situation, if a restitution judgment is entered in this case, the check would be written to the state of South Carolina, not to individual claimants, and then it would be up to the state of South Carolina to distribute those funds as per the statute. So that was a distinction that Nevada versus Bank of America made, actually, in that case when they were distinguishing are saying that their ruling was consistent with their ruling previously in Lucent. They said the fact that the check was going to the state of Nevada to the extent there would be a judgment for damages was significant to them. Well, under 39-5-50, that would certainly be the situation. Your Honor, on the, I think we've already touched on the CAFA purpose of expanding jurisdiction. This is certainly not the situation where CAFA would be concerned about a case that's brought by the State Attorney General's office. The language in CVS Pharmacy, a decision from the panel from the Fourth Circuit last year, has a lot of language on that point. We cited it in our brief, and I think it is clearly applicable. It says, where the state, who is a plaintiff, raises no federal question, and where all the persons on whose behalf the state has filed this action are its own citizens, then the sovereign protection from removal arises in its most powerful form. Constitutional independence of state governments and state court jurisdictions was their concern, and it still is the concern today. To the extent that the defendants believe that private counsel could somehow collude with the Attorney General's office to defeat federal court jurisdiction, I would assert to you that that is not what happened today in this case. But if it were to be a problem, it's a problem for Congress, and they certainly could deal with it if they needed to. Your Honors, I don't have anything else unless you have any further questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Campbell.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Parr?
I'd just like to respond to a few things that my colleague mentioned in her argument. The state is proposing that the claims of the 100 or more persons be jointly tried here because each restitution claim requires a decision that there has been an unfair trade practice that violates the statute. And every one of those claims would have to have that decided, and they are proposing that they be tried in this action. So there is a proposal that claims be jointly tried. And the state, for the first time in the argument, has suggested, I don't believe their brief said this, that if there were a restitution ordered, that the check would be paid to the state of South Carolina. There's no statutory language that allows that in our statute. There might be in other state unfair trade practice acts, but not in this one. The language of this one is quoted in the complaint, and it says the court may order the restitution to the people who suffer ascertainable loss. It doesn't say that the court may order the restitution be paid for the state so that it can decide how to distribute it. That's not in the statute. So there's no basis in the statute for the position that the check would be written to the state of South Carolina. The amount requirement does not make sense the way the state seeks to apply it. If you look at the statute, we have a definition of mass action that is deemed to be removable under paragraphs 2 through 10. And you go to see what a mass action is in section B, and it says essentially it has to include monetary relief claims of 100 more persons proposed to be tried jointly. Then you go to section 2, and there you see there has to be a $5 million amount in controversy. And if all that is met, then we come to the exception in 1332D11B1I, which says, except that jurisdiction shall exist only over those plaintiffs whose claims in a mass action, the exception shows that it's there once there already is a mass action, satisfy the jurisdictional amounts under subsection A. So what that means is this has to be more like an individual case in which if you have an amount requirement met by one plaintiff, then you have supplemental jurisdiction over the others. That's what the Supreme Court said in Exxon versus Alapata, and that's what that exception is designed to do. Now, the 11th Circuit has dicta that it thinks that you would have to remand these other claims. That dicta is based primarily on the Senate report that this court has already rejected in CVS because that Senate report wasn't finalized until 10 days after the CAFA was already passed. And so the 11th Circuit was relying on something it should not have relied on. It should have been sticking with the language of the statute. Also want to address the contention that that CAFA was not intended to apply to Prince Patria actions. The statements from the floor, as this court has said over and over again, are not reliable indications of what the whole Congress meant to do. The language of the statute is there. There are references and debates. Some members of Congress thought that Perens Patria actions, that it wasn't necessary to exempt them because they were already exempted. We don't know what they thought. They may have been thinking of Perens Patria actions as actions for injunctive relief, like the SNAP case. And as we know, the mass action definition requires there be claims for monetary relief. So that may have been what the person thought. So what we have is the language of the statute, and we know that Congress refused to adopt language exempting Perens Patria actions from the application of the statute. So that leaves the courts to follow the language of the statute that we have been through, which says, forget about whole case or claim by claim. Look at the case and see if it is an action in which claims of monetary relief of 100 or more persons are proposed to be tried jointly, which is the case here. And if you've got the $5 million, you've got minimal diversity, which we have here, and none of the exceptions apply. There are many exceptions that Congress, the political process was hard at work here because they were dealing with these very sensitive issues. If that's the case, there's supposed to be federal jurisdiction. No one is suggesting that the plaintiff's counsel engaged in collusion or anything improper. Good lawyers do whatever they can to get an advantage for their clients. And Congress knew that. And good lawyers here decided that they didn't want their restitution claims tried, handled by the MDL in California. So rather than keeping them in that case, they took them out. And they got together with the Attorney General of South Carolina to bring them back in state court. They thought they had an advantage there. They didn't want those claims to be tried in federal court. Congress did not want that tactic to succeed. It's not that it's collusive, it's just a tactic. Congress did not want states to be able to use Prince Patria to withdraw whole categories of cases from the federal courts when federal court jurisdiction was important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parr. Appreciate it very much.